Blog Talk Radio.
Let's get lost in a better place. Pick up the world, travel through time and space. So much to learn, so much to see. A chance to escape reality. Open your mind and your heart. Gain new knowledge, get a fresh new start. MJ Network will bring you there. So let's talk about it when live and on the air.
Morning, everyone. This is Fran Lewis. This is MJ Network. And today, former FBI agent Michael Tabman and I are going to tackle the government shutdown, the FBI investigation, and anything else that comes to mind that we decide to talk about. So, there are many agencies that are affected. 9 out of 15 federal departments and a number of agencies are affected by the shutdown, including the EPA, the IRS, and the Department of State Housing, Urban Development, Treasury, Agriculture, Commerce, Interior Justice, and Homeland Security. You can tell I did my research on this one. So, good morning. And could you explain to our listeners what exactly a government shutdown is and how dire this is to everyone in our economy?
Hey, good morning, Fran. Thanks for having me back on. It's been a while since we spoke.
So yes, it
nice
has.
Nice to visit with you again. Yeah. Well, the government shutdown is response to Congress failing to pass a budget that would authorize the government to spend money. They have no money, so they can't pay people. They can't spend money on various other things, with the exception of essential duties. So, for example, I was in the FBI. I was at headquarters in 1995 when we had that shutdown. And in all honesty, I don't remember if I lost a paycheck or not. I just can't remember that. But I can tell you this. I was living in Washington, D.C. area, three young kids, and surviving on just the paycheck of an FBI agent. So you can imagine, you know, we weren't living on easy street either. So had we lost a paycheck, it would have been difficult. But ours didn't go on. This is the longest one in history, so ours was long, but not this long. So I probably could have survived losing one paycheck. You know, everyone, you know, has a different situation. So it was difficult. But basically, it comes down to the fact that we don't have money to operate because there's no budget been approved. But there's a recognition that government must continue its essential duties. And essential duties, I don't know that that's actually articulated anywhere in the statutes. It's somewhat discretionary, I believe, to the agency. So, for example, in the FBI, all the FBI agents were considered essential. And we all showed up. And then from the support employees, we picked a certain amount of who would be essential based on just getting by during the shutdown. So some people were furloughed, they were sent home. I remember we sent some home and then called them back, so we did need them. And they also worked without pay. But at least at this time, everybody got back pay, even those who were furloughed and didn't work. And that's fair because it's not their fault that they were furloughed, but it just shows you the inefficiency of a shutdown, how little accomplishes. We send people home, we pay them anyway. The whole shutdown is a debacle of our government. It's a result of a Congress and the president that just cannot come to any agreement here, and it just shows complete dysfunctionality.
You know what bothers me? I'm sitting here taking notes at the same time, just speaking, and it was on my original paper. It bothers me because I know we have three branches of government, at least we think we do, and I listen to him speak, and it's very hard to listen to him speak. And he says, because I can do that. How is it that with checks and balances and three branches of government, they couldn't stop him from doing this? And I think that's bothering a lot of people.
Well, it is. This politics here. Look, the Congress, Senate, and the House have come up, my understanding, with budgets that both got bipartisan support and was ready to go until the president heard from his associates on conservative news stations that he shouldn't approve this, and he backed down. Now, there's proposals out there. Mitch McConnell is refusing to take it to the Senate for a vote. They're saying, well, it's not going to meet the president's approval. But you take a vote. It's amazing they had all that time to vote on dismantling Obamacare, how many times, knowing it would never pass. We had time for that, but no time for this. take the vote, send it to the president, and take it from there. That's my opinion. Let's get it on record.
This is scary. So which agencies, I mean, there are so many questions. Social Security, Medicaid, Medicare. I mean, what about W-2 forms for taxes? The Postal Service has been affected. And I know TSA has had a problem. There were tons of articles on that. TSA had a problem that somebody even got through the other day with a weapon. That's scary. So,
that's not the first time.
I mean, there's so many agencies that are affected. What happens now? I mean, I watched something on the news yesterday. I was in tears. I felt so bad that these Coast Guard wives in Greenberg had to go to a food center in order to get food and provisions that they would have for their kids and themselves. Long Island is having Long Island Cares. How is this affecting the economy?
Well, from what I've read, it's going to affect the economy terribly by all the money that's not getting spent.
Yeah.
And you have all these people not buying food, they're going to food banks, not doing extra things that they might do. And they're not going to make up for that when they finally get their pay back, which I'm pretty confident they'll get. I just can't imagine they won't get back pay. But that'll just go to catching up to where they were. So we're taking all this money out of the economy right now. Mm-hmm. So in terms of money out there, it's going to affect it that way. But to me, it's more important of what it does to the morale of the federal worker. Yeah. Now, you talked about someone making it through TSA with a gun. Now, you know, if you look at my social media, if you look at my books, I'm not a big fan of TSA anyway. They've, in my opinion, have been highly ineffective and inefficient. Every time there's a test of trying to get things through, you know, bogus weapons or explosives, they fail 95% of the time. So I don't see them as highly efficient anyway. But nevertheless, this could be a result, or certainly it's reasonable to think about the fact that you're going to have lower morale. Now, I remember back, you know, in the Bureau when we went through the shutdown, you know, people getting frustrated, what was going on, less resources. But I always felt we did our job. You know, I personally, no one I knew ever said, well, I'm going to work less or I'm not going to give it the same attention because I'm not getting paid. And I hope all government workers approach it that way. You go into government service, especially if you're law enforcement, and while TSA officers are not law enforcement, they're certainly critical to our national security. You hope they go in there and they say, yes, this is bad. I understand that. I'm getting screwed, because they are. But we still have to maintain our awareness. We're still going to approach our job with the same energy, both physically and mentally, that we would irrespective of a shutdown. I hope that's a message going through. I know it's easy to say sitting here on the sidelines now. I get that. But you go into public service for the purpose of serving the public, and they just have to maintain that dedication to what they're doing and not let the shutdown affect them. And I hope that's what's happening.
You know, I listen to people in the street, whatever, and it's sad. People have been asking these following questions. Is it safe to travel? How is it affecting the military and border control? What about food stamps? What about the wall and immigration? They've been asking a lot of questions. You answered the question about getting paid and vacation paid, and there are so many people that are furloughed, and there are people that are working without getting paid, that I know that. So how is this affecting just the military and safe travel? And is it safe to travel? Seriously.
Well, I never will tell people whether it's safe to travel or not, you know, but if you would ask me, would I travel? Yes, I would. I would. And I do that based on the fact that government, as I know, continues to work. They bring in the essential people. They bring in the essential services. Mm-hmm. We see that IRS now is calling back some of its employees that they have furloughed, saying now because we're so backed up, we need you back there. And the question is it essential that tax returns get processed? Is that essential to our national security? Maybe not. Is it essential to people that they get the refunds? Probably so, for these very reasons, that many of those will be government workers or other people that might get affected by a slowdown in the economy due to the shutdown. So, you know, essential to what is the question. The IRS's case, and I imagine the military and TSA, essential to them doing their duty. And, you know, TSA, which is a matter of providing adequate security to travelers, I do imagine that Homeland Security, again, irrespective of all my criticism of Homeland Security and TSA over the years, I do believe they will function to the point they can of providing adequate security for our travelers.
So
the answer is I'm not telling you in general, so I would
travel. How long could this last? I mean, this is 27 days,
right? That's the scary part. Yeah, that's a scary
I mean,
part. How
and
long
he
will it last?
and you listen to him say nothing, and there's like air coming between someplace, the ears, and he says nothing, and he just says, because I can do this, because I think it's right. I mean, his rationale is frightening. So is there a way that the Democrats or anybody could get this to stop? I mean, I know what Pelosi did was
there is a way today.
She's not inviting him to the State of the Union, the address. I was like,
that was
a power play.
Yeah, that was a pretty slick power play by Nancy Pelosi. And again, the question of security is, we could argue that point, but this is clearly a power play by her. And I guess when you're up against a politician like Donald Trump, you have to play in his ball game. You got to do that. But yes, there is a way to resolve this. The government, Congress, and President could pass continuing resolution, which would authorize the government to continue until they work out these final details. And that would mean putting some things on hold, the things that they can't agree on, such as would be the wall. And I know the president would see that as a loss, and heaven forbid he sees that. But it wouldn't be a loss. It would just be a matter of getting the government up and running, agreeing on the things they can agree on, and then discussing the things that are still open to discussion. Mm-hmm. So that can be done, yes.
It can be done, but will he listen? Probably. Who knows? He's got his own mindset. So this all started, I want to make sure, because I have 1,000 articles in front of me. I think I read about 50 articles on this to make sure that I knew my facts before I go on to the next topic. This started because he wanted the money for the wall, correct? I want to make sure that I'm right.
That's my understanding, yes. There was a budget approved, bipartisan, in the House and the Senate that they expected the president to sign. But then when the president got his criticism from the conservative news stations, he backed down and said, no, I'm not doing this until I get full funding for my wall. That's my understanding as well.
Now, what is his purpose of keeping these people out? What is his purpose of creating this wall? And my other question is, what makes him think that just because you have this huge wall that people are not going to get in anyway? I mean, that's very nice.
And that brings up a lot of questions within that question. So let's talk about the wall. Let's just talk about that, and then, irrespective of politics for the moment. So a barricade that controls egress, and more ingress than egress, controls ingress to a country or an area, that is not anything that's not consistent with the principles of security. We have barriers all over the place where we want to control who can make it in. So the concept alone is not wrong. There's nothing wrong with that. We do have fencing and barriers on parts of the border where we think it's effective. So the concept of putting a wall up or a barricade up, there's nothing wrong with that on its own. Where I disagree, and I think many people who are knowledgeable of security, will say, do we need a wall coast to coast, irrespective of its efficacy in a certain area? And I would say no. I say it's a waste of money. I think the insistence on that by Donald Trump is to maintain this promise, appeal to his base, and really build a monument to himself. To say, look what I've done. I said I'm going to build a wall. It's everlasting. It's a physical structure. It's there. It's almost a monument to me. And I do think that's his goal, at least partially.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of security, we know that, for example, narcotics, and we're hearing this now through experts, we're hearing it through testimony, the El Chapo trial, and just based on my own experience, we know that most narcotics are making it to this country through legal ports of entry. And why, if you just think about it from a common sense perspective, how much drugs can you hide and bring in any kind of car, a truck, or a ship coming in through another port, compared to somebody carrying a backpack through very tough terrain? Right? Yeah, someone may do that. I read an article where recently some kids were picked up with maybe 100 pounds of marijuana. They were backpacking. Well, they were picked up, one, that shows you how ineffective that is. Two, they said this is how the drug cartels do it. I don't think so. For obvious reasons, look, it was so risky, and tons of marijuana is not any great shipment to the cartels. I think this is probably a very unsophisticated operation. But if you think about the sophistication that we have, and I saw it going back to my days working narcotics, which was a long time ago, the way they're able to secrete drugs and money in vehicles and other conveyances, it is much more effective and efficient to do it that way and try to smuggle it by sending kids across a very tough terrain. So that only makes sense. So if we want to knock, and even for people, how will people come in? They're smuggled in usually through big trucks, even in vehicles. We see how they do that, how they're hidden in vehicles. It's amazing and it's cruel how it's done. And I think of all these poor people who are human trafficked in, and we found them turning up dead and tracked the trailers down in Texas. That wasn't too long ago that happened. So that is how they do it. So the question is, what are we trying to stop? So we're trying to stop, drugs, we know it comes through ports of entry. Human smuggling, we know, again, it comes through legal ports of entry and various other ways comes in. But now let's take an area on the southwest border, and I ran a drug and violent gang task force for the FBI on the southwest border state. I'm certainly familiar with the challenges there. We've worked on those cases. But if you have a community where people from Mexico are running across the border, committing crimes, whether it be violent crimes or burglaries of homes, and running back to get protection in Mexico, might a border wall or some barricade be useful there? Yeah, it might be. It certainly might be. But I think what the community has to do then, and I posted this on social media recently, is the community should come up with an idea of what they want to do. How do they want it? Based on their standards, the ecology, environment, and what do they think will work for their community. And let them decide. So my proposal was, I put on social media, is let's take all this money and let's put it in the form of grant. And let local communities, whether it be through their local leaders, through the governor, whomever, apply for this money and then build any kind of barricade that they feel is necessary for their community in a way that will be aesthetic to the community, be effective, and meet their community standards. That's what I think would be most effective. But a wall-to-wall, I'm sorry, coast-to-coast wall, waste of money, ineffective, inefficient. Let's just do it on an as-needed basis.
I think he's going to name it the Donald Trump Wall, maybe.
That wouldn't surprise me. That would not surprise me.
That would nothing would surprise me. I mean, what was this thing that I read? And I'm telling you, I read 1,000 articles on this stuff, on this steel wall made of steel. And does he really think that Mexico is going to pay for the barrier and the wall? I mean, seriously.
Mind-boggling. Yeah, they went back and forth. Is it concrete? Is it steel? Steel could be cut through. All these different machinations of what the wall should look like. Again, I go back to this. Let a local community decide what, if any, barricade they want, and then decide on how it should look. You know, I saw some coverage of this plan for this coast-to-coast wall, where in some communities there are going to be homes that are on the south side of the wall. So they're wedged between the wall and Mexico and the Rio Grande. I don't know how they would function in that predicament. That, to me, again, it just doesn't make sense. And all the environmental laws that have to be waived for this wall, again, is that necessary? We can't forget our environment. I think our environment right now is more of a national crisis than the border. Not that the border is not a problem. I don't want to be misunderstood. We do have a problem at the border. We've had it for a long time. But when you see that immigration is down from illegal immigration and apprehensions are down from 2000 to 2016 by 1.6 million to, I think, 300,000. You can't say that we have this immediate crisis, national crisis. It's a problem, and we need to address it. But if it's a crisis that the president of the Republicans couldn't address for 2 years when they controlled the government, and we see that the issue is diminishing rather than growing, again, we see less people crossing, issue that needs to be addressed. I don't argue that point. I've been around border problems all my career in the FBI, but it's not a national crisis. To me, I'm more concerned about the immediate crisis of climate control and what these reports say will happen if we don't take changes in the next 10 to 12 years in the long-term impact. So, it is scary, but let's address it in a rational way and as naive as this is, and as apolitical a way as we can. But it should be addressed. But addressed in a rational way.
You know what bothers me too? I'm sitting here with my pen here.
Well, how long do we have for that?
we have plenty of time. We have another 40 minutes, people, maybe more. the government, doesn't the government, who owns the border? I mean, and where in, have, I mean, he came up with this idea to you know, have a wall. How tall is this wall? And what would prevent somebody from actually climbing over it? I mean, that may sound a little strange, but I looked at how much was done already, or what he started. How tall would this thing be, and would anybody be able to get over it? And like you said, those poor people, I saw that, you know, half of them won't be able to function or get anywhere. And how long is the wall? Where is it going to go, all the way from us to them and then back again? I mean, where does it stop, and where does it start?
Right. From what I understand, he's the president's going for coast-to-coast wall. Doesn't make sense to me. I saw a funny thing on Facebook yesterday. Some of those things are cute. And they said, what if Mexico decides to build stairs on their side of the wall? I thought that was a great little funny comment. I don't know how high. I mean, whatever you could build, someone could build something on the other side, get over. But now with the drones, with private planes, with tunnels, and with all the other ports of entry, it won't have great effect. Now, again, some locations, if we're just talking about unsophisticated criminals, again, are just running across the border to commit crimes, a barricade may stop them. It may be effective. We can't totally throw that concept out. There's nothing wrong with it in terms of being a principle of security. But we have to understand, what is it we're trying to stop, and where are we trying to stop it as effective? So we have to look at, what is the crime problem on that part of the border, and what do we need to do to stop it? So if we know that drugs, for example, is coming into legal ports of entry, we need better detection technology. How do we detect drugs hidden in vehicles or other conveyances? We have good technology, but obviously we need more. Why do we have an opioid crisis? Is that really from coming across the border? Is it because of what's going on now with the easy access to false prescriptions and abuse of opioids? Is it more of an internal problem, which I tend to think it is? So we have to look at the problem, and this is where intelligence, so both criminal intelligence and mankind intelligence, has to come in. You have to look at the problem, analyze it, break it down as to what the threat is, where it is, and address it on a specific basis. Not this global wall that we're going to build from coast to coast.
But does he know where the threat is? Does he understand what he's doing? Does he comprehend the gravity of what he's doing, or is he just doing it because he says he can, with his Me Too attitude? That's what I've been reading, and that's, you know, before we bring to the next topic of discussion that's in front of me. I mean, it's just like he thinks he could just do it, and it's just, I don't even know if he has a conscience to realize what he's doing to all the people that he's destroying, and that's sad.
Well,
I mean, the national park, the Smithsonian, everything, it's got to be affecting the workers down there, and tourism and everything, seriously.
You know, of course it is. And, you know, recently I was on another media station, asked again about the shutdown, and they asked me what do I think the biggest impact was. And again, my heart does go out to those not getting paid. I'm not unaware of that pain. But I also feel pain for those who, especially during the holiday season, travel to go to parks and monuments and museums, and they're not available. I mean, most people don't have money to just reschedule a new vacation and lose whatever money they spent for that, whether it be tickets, whether they go there and they can't enjoy the things they want to enjoy. They may not have a chance to do it again or do it when the kids are still at home. So my heart really goes out to those people as well. Those are important parts of life. These trips we take, these memories we make with our families, this is what we live for. And we know that those are more important than the toys we get in life, or the memories we make. And so those who are losing those vacations, losing those chances to explore something with their children, I feel for them as well. But you asked a question that goes into what's in the president's mind. And I've heard all about, you know, the psychologists who aren't supposed to make, or psychiatrists who aren't supposed to make diagnoses without seeing a patient, but they're doing it anyway with the president. So from a layman's perspective, again, you and I aren't doctors. We can't make a diagnosis. But you look at the man, and you have to think, what is driving this megalomaniac, someone totally caught up with themselves, in love with themselves. And you have to wonder, does Donald Trump do what's best for the country, or does Donald Trump first do what's best for Donald Trump and his family? Mm-hmm. And if you look at everything he does, you know, renting out space to the Secret Service, you look at what's going on with the Trump charity, I don't know if it's called, what it was called, the Trump Foundation. you have to look and say, this is a man who's been brought up in privilege, has always had privilege, has gotten away with everything he wants to get with. And he, you know, in one way, Donald Trump is a winner. He does know how to get what he wants. But that is very important, to get what he wants, and he's gotten it. He's had this, he's built this empire with his name all over it. Hey, if I knew how to do that, I would do it too. I don't begrudge anyone's financial success. I don't begrudge it. He's known how to get what he wants. He became the president of the United States against all odds, and we could question his methods and that, but he did it. The fact is he did it, and he's there. And I do believe that Donald Trump first thinks what is great for Donald Trump, what makes him look great, mm-hmm. what soothes his ego, and takes it from there. That's my belief based on everything I see.
Well, I'll tell you, as an educator that sees things a little differently maybe, I agree with you, and I also think that I would love to know how he grew up and if he had low self-esteem. I know that I read a book about him and his Me Too attitude, and his father taught him that he could do whatever he wants and only his opinion matters, and that he's never wrong in that whole thing. I actually read a book and I refused to review it because I said I'm not going to put my name to something like that. But I did get a lot of information. I just wonder if he has so low self-esteem that he has to build himself up in the public eye so that people think that he's actually so great. Before we get to the next topic of conversation, which is
I don't know if it's low self-esteem or if he just does really believe in himself. It could be that as well, that he just sees himself as a savior and for whatever of America, or at least for himself. I don't know what he sees, but to me, I think it's pretty clear that Donald Trump is doing what's right for Donald Trump and the Trump family first. That's just my opinion.
Well,
based
if
on
really
the totality.
Family, if it's just him. Yeah.
Yeah, and I basically not. You know, look, I look at Donald Trump years ago, you know, 30 years ago, when he was on, he was interviewed a lot as to whether he would run for president. I back then thought he made some pretty rational arguments. I was like, wow, maybe this guy can. He's been successful, and back then he stated positions that were probably more Democratic. And he said he and by that I mean with you know Democrats. He said he identified more with the Democrats and Republicans back then. And I listened to him and said, well, maybe this guy's got something. And just as an aside here, many, many years ago, I was about to leave the FBI office, and my phone rang. And I just figured, let me pick it up, a real quick call. And I spoke to someone. I finished the conversation. And another agent said to me, hey, Tabman, who did you just talk to? You got a big smile on your face. Well, I had spoken to Donald Trump. And just for clarification, This was just on somebody's security clearance. They used Donald Trump as a reference. So no indication there's anything criminal. I don't mean to imply that, and I don't want to be misunderstood. It was pretty innocuous. But he called up, and I answered the phone, and he said, Mike? I said, yes. It was Donald Trump here, because I left him a message. I'm like, wow. The guy called up on his own. I didn't have to wait 20 minutes for a secretary. Mm-hmm. He was nice. He was polite. He was funny. And I really enjoyed my conversation with him. So I don't come with some long history of begrudgment against Donald Trump. At one time I admired him. I thought he made sense. I enjoyed my five-minute conversation with him. I found him extremely personal. But what's become of him now, I think, is a matter of I don't know if he even believes everything he says. We're just saying what he knows he has to say to get what he wants. So that's why I find it so troubling.
What bothers me is that he's got a cabinet that he hired that's not the same as when he started 3 years ago, 4 years ago, and he has people that can advise him, and he doesn't listen. And anybody that disagrees with him, he fires, which is frightening, because you had these people that you trust, and now you're telling them that you don't trust them, which brings me to the next question. The FBI has two kinds of investigations. I'm telling you, I read a lot, criminal and counterintelligence. When they decide to go after investigate the president, what kind of, it's called counterintelligence, correct? So what was the main reason, and what does it have to do with the fact that he fired Comey?
Well, there's a $64,000 question that everybody's waiting
I know.
For will be answered by the Mueller report. right, so you're correct.
No
there's two investigations which go to the mission of the FBI. One is criminal and one is counterintelligence. So the criminal one is, I think, pretty straightforward. We look at crimes, white-collar crime, organized crime, narcotics, which I spent most of my career working, that and organized crime, some of the violent crimes that fall under federal offenses. So that's pretty straightforward. The counterintelligence is a little bit of a different beast, and we look at investigations that may not necessarily or probably will not result in an indictment or a trial or a criminal conviction. We're looking to find who are the spies working against the United States. So for spying against another country overseas, that would be the venue of the CIA, and they're very good at what they do. In terms of weeding out the spies who are working against us, which would be Russian spies or people in the government who are spying against us, that's a counterintelligence. But I must make a point, though. If you are a U.S. citizen, such as someone in the CIA or the FBI, and we've had these, spying against the United States, then you're committing a crime. So we go over the espionage. So it wouldn't just be a counterintelligence when it's a U.S. person. Now we're looking at a potential criminal charge. So they tend to mix over there, okay? So if it's just looking at a Russian spy, we may not want to bring a criminal charge of espionage against a foreigner and charge them. We like to know who they are. We like to keep tabs on them. Put what's called a FISA wiretap. We've heard about that. You know, a FISA to hear what he's doing and who he's meeting with to identify maybe American people working against us with their assets. Or maybe we want to send them out, you know, get them expelled from the country, send them out because they are spies, they're doing damage. But generally, we want to know who they are, what they're doing, and want to keep tabs on them because we could use that to our advantage and perhaps turn them to become a double agent for us. So we look at them from that perspective. So that's the intelligence investigation. So if we're looking at a counterintelligence investigation, there was reason to, and again, like any investigation, whether it's on the president or anybody, it's opened up with the perspective of we have indicia, this indication of this happening. It doesn't mean that anybody's necessarily guilty. Right, so opening the investigation doesn't mean there was a conclusion that the president was working as an asset for the Russians. There was a suspicion, and I got to tell you, if we opened up an investigation of the president of the United States, there had to be strong indication. This had to be approved at the very highest levels of the Department of Justice. Certainly the director signed off on it, probably the attorney general, maybe the deputy attorney general. But this received the highest level of review and going over and say, are we sure that at least the facts that we're basing on are correct? Is there so much indication that this president may be working on behalf of the Russians that we need to open this investigation? So again, not conclusive, but certainly had to be a lot of predication. And if we just look at the president's conduct, that to me is not shocking. You know, you talk about firing Comey. You look at that, but you look at that in the context of the president's behavior at Helsinki, saying, I don't believe what my intelligence agencies are saying. I'm believing Vladimir Putin because he says so. Could you imagine if we ran our investigations based on what people said? I didn't do it. Can you imagine if we walked away from our investigations? People say, it wasn't me. My goodness, I can't imagine even the fact that he even had the nerve to say that publicly, that he doesn't believe it because Putin said so. That was, to me, the most troubling thing he said in terms of that. And when I have my arguments with my friends who are on the other side of the aisle politically, and I remember one guy who I speak to fairly often. We argue a lot on Facebook. I mean argue in a good sense, you know, we're friendly argument. And he said to me, oh, what happened there didn't bother me. I think to myself, okay, that is just disingenuous. I don't believe that. That didn't bother you. And if that had been Obama saying that, I cannot imagine the reaction on the other side of the aisle, the Republicans, if Obama had defended Putin against his own intelligence agencies. There would have been a cry of treason, and they may have looked to impeach him if Obama had said that. I can't imagine what the reaction would have been.
I can't imagine this is actually happening. It's scary. So it says this congressional transcripts obtained by CNN. I'm telling you, I know all this by heart here. Yeah, it's scary. By CNN reveal new details into how the FBI launched the investigation into Trump. And yet, I have an article right in front of me that is from this year, 114, it says, and it's in yellow, actually came out, no evidence has emerged publicly that Mr. Trump was secretly in contact with or took direction from the Russian government officials. supposedly from an FBI spokesman, and spokeswoman and spokesman for the special counsel office both declined to comment. I mean, how do you actually prove that the documents that he actually did this? And then there was an interview with Jeanine Moreau, and she actually asked him if he worked for the Russians. I mean, really? Seriously?
The fact that
that was my mark.
Yeah. Right. So, yeah. So to answer your question, how do you prove it? We prove it like we prove any other case. It's the totality of the evidence. And I agree. I have not seen anything in public that indicates that he's – or proves, rather. Let me say proves that the president has taken the direction of the Russians. I personally am starting to wonder what's going on. I think, again, going back to Helsinki, I know after that, I and many other people I've seen who are experts in the intelligence and law enforcement have the experience that I share – start to wonder themselves. They said this might be indicative of the fact that something is being held over Trump by the Russians. I think it's fair to at least suspect that based on his conduct. But you prove it through totality of the evidence. We don't know what evidence Mueller has or does not have. If someone made recordings of conversations, if there's documentary evidence or a pattern of conduct that would support that, you know, looking at everything, not just the statements he's made, but other actions he may have taken as president, other financial dealings he may have with the Russians, and you put that in a timeline, and you say, gee, this happened. They had a meeting here, and then he made this decision on his business, and he made this statement politically. Then he had this conversation with Michael Cohen or someone else that may have not been taped, and these referrals here make sense in terms of everything else. It could be hardcore evidence. It could be circumstantial evidence. And this is important. We always talk about guilty, innocent until proven guilty. Absolutely. Mm. But in this context, and we want to be fair, you know, that generally applies or applies to a criminal trial. You know, innocent before being proven guilty. Criminal trial. And it also goes to a sense of how we work in the United States, or just a sense of fairness. But when we're talking about the President of the United States or any public official, and we present these cases, we don't have to prove this beyond a reasonable doubt. We don't have to prove guilty for if someone's innocent. These are information facts that we as voters can look at and make our determination. Do these facts indicate that we may not be able to trust the president? And I imagine those are going to fall right along party lines. That's going to fall, you know, those who support Trump are not going to look at this and say, yeah, this indicates that he's an agent of the Russians. Those who don't support Trump are going to interpret it that way. And then, but we hope that people in the middle will just make a fair assessment of the facts. And then we have to see, let people decide for themselves. What does this evidence tell us? And is this someone we want to vote for president when the elections come up in 2020? I don't think there's anything wrong there with getting those facts out there and letting the public make assessments for themselves.
But does the public really listen? Listen and believe everything they said. Do they ever? I mean, I read all this stuff to see which. You know, I'm not taking sides. I'm just listening and learning. But the public, the media, has a lot to do with this. It depends on how they present it, as to how, and each station presents it in a different way. Yesterday they had, and this morning at 5 o'clock when I was up watching the news, they were talking about Mueller. What happens? He can't fire him, can he? Because they're saying that if he fires him and fires him from the investigation, he can be removed from office. Is that true? Can they really do that?
I don't know who said that and what they're basing that on, because this conversation has come up fairly often. I mean, the argument is that the president has great latitude in firing people. Like, for example, they said he could fire the FBI director. So therefore, because he has that power, he could not obstruct the justice. You know, a couple of things bother me. I remember just all my time in the FBI, and I can't find anything to back up what I'm saying here. I've Googled this, and I can't really find information to the contrary. But, and so I'm admitting that. So what I'm saying here, I cannot back up. But I always remember that the FBI director could be fired with cause. And the reason behind that was, that, again, they put in a 10-year term for the FBI director after Hoover, you know, died. So in the legislation that created this 10-year term, it specifically mentioned this would take effect after the tenure of the current director, being Hoover. So the 10-year term was there to prevent the politicization of the FBI. So the president, whoever it was, couldn't hire and fire an FBI director based on his political whims or, you know, perhaps a Watergate investigation going on. So that was always my understanding. And when William Sessions was fired, President Clinton presented cause, mm-hmm. which had to do with an internal investigation that he misused government resources. And I'm not passing judgment on whether he did or didn't, but that was the predication that President Clinton used to remove Sessions and bring in Louis Freeh. And I think I remember Louis Freeh stating something to the effect that he knew he couldn't be removed without cause. And the reason that came up mm-hmm. is because there was no secret about the animosity that developed between Director Freeh and President Clinton. That was pretty well known both inside and outside the Beltway. So I think I remember Freeh making that statement somewhere. That's just based on my memory. But I've always known it to be with cause, but I cannot back that up. But it would make sense if you think about why we gave the 10-year term to avoid the politicization, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, of the FBI. But everything I read now says the president had the power to fire Comey, therefore it could not be obstruction. But I have to disagree with that because you can have the power to do things. It doesn't mean that your motivation doesn't come in question. So, for example, in the United States, I think almost every state is employment at will, right? You work mm-hmm. at the will of your employer. But if you are fired and it can be proven you did it because of race or some other protected mm-hmm. class, well, you no longer have the power to do that. It's discriminatory. So, yes, your motivation does come into question if deciding if you have the power to do something. Police officer has the power to make an arrest. Doesn't mean they have the power. You know, they can do so if they find out that arrest was based on discriminatory factors. They weren't based on, you know, the totality effect. In the FBI, you know, management, we had the power to do a lot of personnel actions. And as we've come to learn, certainly how I did, is that if you're accused of doing that for a reason other than a personnel action, well, then you no longer have the power to do it. So that I don't think that argument holds water, at least as far as I'm concerned, but it's certainly being used as a way to defend the president. So to answer your question, can the president fire Mueller? Well, I mean, I guess he can. He's got the power to fire the director. He's got the power to fire the attorney general. And I guess he's got the power to fire someone who works in the Department of Justice other than career employees, but those who are appointed.
That's scary because I was watching the news this morning, actually, and it did say they were having a meeting, whatever, in one of the centers, one of the conferences, and it said that if the reason why they feel that he has him remove Mueller is because they said that they could remove him. And that was on the news at 5 o'clock this morning on Channel 12.
Well, I think that was...
That's scary.
Yeah, sorry, I mean to interrupt.
I don't know.
Yeah, I think that was a little more of a conclusion there, sure. That may not be... I think it would give cause for mm-hmm. Congress to start impeachment proceedings on the president. And then, of course, they'd have to then have the Senate remove him, which right now is kind of questionable. So I don't think it means they could just summarily remove the president from office. I think the intent they were saying that that would give pause to start impeachment proceedings. And whether those proceedings would be – the impeachment would be successful is a whole other question.
And there was another thing here. They have a new director. So what does he think about Director McCabe? Does he feel that he's doing what he wants him to do? Or all of these people that remain in his employ, are they programmed to do what he tells them to do? Otherwise, they're going to be fired? We have about 15 minutes.
All right, well, yeah. Okay, let me just – you mentioned McCabe. I'm sorry, just a slip. McCabe, of course, was Andrew McCabe, who was Comey's deputy director and then became mm-hmm. acting director after Comey's firing.
Yeah.
The director of the FBI now is Christopher Wray, appointed by the president.
Mm-hmm.
And again, you say, can he be fired? Well, again, just based on our last conversation, you know, everything I'm hearing says yes, though my understanding was always without cause. The FBI, since Hoover, has struggled, and I think fairly successfully, to maintain its independence. So, you know, look, all agents, including those up to the ranks, have their political beliefs. And I can tell you just based on my experience, FBI agents, law enforcement are generally conservative Republicans. And, again, if you read my books and you hear my other commentaries, you know, that's been borne out pretty well. But I've never, during my time in the FBI, felt that a public mm-hmm. corruption case was a compromise because an agent or a supervisor's belief was that, they're a Republican or they're a Democrat, they can't be fair. I've never seen that. I've never believed that. And even though there were biases that came out during, you know, Comey's administration, having to do with Trump. The Inspector General's report still said that those biases did not impact the investigation. And I know, if you're, again, if you're pro-Trump, you say that's not true. If you're on the other side, you say, well, it's true. I believe that because, again, agents are kind of conditioned not to allow those biases to interfere. We would diminish, if not totally cripple, our ability to conduct a public corruption investigation. We would lose the faith of the public in those cases. So we try hard not to let that happen. I think, and I've been even on my own show, Crimes and Times, I was highly critical of the agents in this matter. They gave the president a lot of fodder to attack them. They should have known better than to allow their political beliefs become so public and to question the motivation. Two people in particular, I've said, who are high up there and have been fired, I think they should have recused themselves immediately from those investigations of Trump and Clinton because of things they've said, because of things that were going on. And I think if they had done that, they would have spared the FBI a lot of self-inflicted pain. Did I answer your question in that long-winded answer?
You did. And before I forget, on Monday, I have Gabriel Vachon and the Good Man. Tuesday at 8 a.m. so far, until if I have to get the date, the time, 8 a.m., KFC, 5:50 a.m., interviewing me about my book, A Daughter's Promise. I just have to find out how long the interview is and the number. But they contacted me, and it's the Brian Thomas Show on KFC, 5:50 a.m. in Chicago. I'm excited.
Fantastic.
On the 24th, yep. I'm going to talk to Derek Volk, and we're going to talk about his son who has Asperger's and the book that he wrote. On the 28th, New York Times author David Rosenfeld, Deck the Hounds. And on the 29th, Jean DeRocha, we're going to talk about Dark Paradise. And the most exciting thing coming up, so far so good, is on February 13th at 10 a.m., Douglas Preston and Lincoln Child, Verses of the Dead. And, yeah, that's just some of what I'm up to. And I'm sure Michael Tabman and I will be up to more than this, that's for sure. So the other question that we didn't get to, maybe we can just touch on it, is this is all affecting health care and the rising cost of health care. You know, you go to the pharmacy, like I got blindsided the other day, and I went in and they said, well, you know, whatever you're taking, it's more money now. And they don't warn you. It's all of a sudden everything is so much more expensive. Even your premiums are going up. So how do you feel about that? I mean, and this, all this with the shutdown and all that affecting that too? Because I know I walked in and said, you know, if you want this drug, it's on one of my insurances is $500 or $700, and one is $40. So, I mean, how does that affect all of this?
Interesting question, Fran. And, again, I have a perspective other than that from just being an FBI agent, is, as you know, last year I was a candidate for governor here in Kansas. And during that run, I went out there on some of those debates. We call them forums, polite word for debate. And the topic of health care came up often because especially then, early 2018, when there's a lot of discussion of totally dismantling Obamacare and its protections, many people on the state level were concerned because without money coming from the federal government, health care was a real challenge. And by health care, I mean health insurance, people adequate coverage so they could afford the health care. And the question was, what can the state do with diminishing federal support? So health care was high on my mind. Another reason it was also is that, and this is going to sound almost contradictory, but the reason I think about it is because I have very good health care based on my pension from the federal government. We're a big pool. Federal employees are a big pool, so that the government can afford to get really good contracts. I'm not insured by the federal government. They're private insurances, but I get my benefits as a result of my pension, and the government helps me with that in terms of being an employer, if that makes sense. Not as the government itself, but as my employer, but employer of many, many people and retirees. I have good health insurance, and I have one son left who's young enough to still be in my insurance, and thankfully, I have a fairly healthy family. Now, why do I say that? Because in light of all that, sometimes I'm sitting there saying, why am I paying so many doctor bills? And why am I paying so much for this one little thing? And then I think about those who do not have, you know, the benefit of my coverage. I think, how are they handling this? And I really get concerned about that because the thought that people would have to choose between food and medicine or or something else. It's just horrifying to me. So I am really keyed into there. And then also from the perspective of a former law enforcement officer, we know that lack of access to health care affects the crime rate. And again, I don't think it takes much common sense to figure, well, if people aren't getting mental health care, if they're not getting the mm-hmm. medicine they need, if they're not getting other things that they require for the health, counseling that they may need, or help for drug addiction, it is not hard to think about how is that affecting people. Is that going to lead them maybe to commit more crimes? And I think that the obvious answer would be yes. If they're not getting the things they need, maybe they commit crime. If they're not getting treated for drugs, if they're not getting counseling, if they're not getting basic health care and the medicine they need, they can't afford it, might that increase the crime rate? I think it's obviously yes. So affordable health care is not just a humanitarian issue, which first and foremost mm-hmm. it is. I think in a country as wealthy as ours, as privileged as so many people are, I do see health care as a basic human right. And it should not be beyond the scope of people to afford basic health care. So since insurance pays for most of it, yes, I think everyone deserves to have affordable health care.
Well, I won't tell you who. I mean, I know a lot of people that don't have it. I know a lot of people that can't afford it. And I know that for those people that can't afford a prescription drug, I know that if you go into Walgreens or Rite Aid or CVS, they have their own card. And I know that Walgreens for a whole family is $35 for the year for everything. For prescriptions, it may not be, you know, from a health insurance company, but it is a discount. There's also GoodRx that you can get online, and they tell you the different pharmacies that you can get different prescriptions, and you know, for free. If you get the prescription, that you know, have a lower rate. There's a whole bunch of discount cards, but I know Walgreens has their own, Walmart has their own. But as far as how this is affecting Medicare and Medicaid. I mean, I know I have from school, because I retired, I have my pension, and I have, you know, a certain amount of drug plan. But I know that also that they don't cover everything. So I had to take out 3 health insurances. And by the time I get done paying that, I'm like, can I pay the rest of my bills? It's expensive, yeah. So, I mean, then you have the public health system, which, you know, where the insurance companies decide what the doctors have to say. They decide, you know, what they're going to pay, what they're not going to pay. And if you ever look at your EOB, the doctor charges maybe $1,200 for something, and they get $50. So that makes it hard, too. I mean, seriously, I don't know how you change that, and I agree, everybody should have some kind of health plan. But before we end, what are you writing? Anything? Are you writing anything for me?
You know, friend, I wrote a book. I have my business book, Walking the Corporate Beat, Police School for Business People. I have then my first novel, uh-huh. Midnight Sin, and my second novel, Bad Intent. So, since I wrote those books, things have changed a little bit. I've got 2 businesses going on now that keep me pretty busy, so I really don't have the time for writing. But I did eke out of about 70% of a book that I wanted to do as a sequel to Bad Intent, because I just felt Detective Zuccarelli was such a colorful character. I felt he deserved, you know, a series. Though the real Detective Zuccarelli wasn't all thrilled with that idea. He said, you know, I don't know if I want to read books anymore. But but I did. But you know what, Fran? When I looked at the book, I myself was not happy with the quality of the book. I said, you know, as a writer, you have to mature, you have to get better, and I didn't feel that mm-hmm. I brought the level of my writing up from my last book to where I wanted it. So I didn't move forward with it, but I am going to try to find some time based on that framework that I have to try to come up with a novel. I have a good percentage of it there, but I want to make it better. I want to really show that I've grown as a writer and something that could really get, you know, some really great feedback and recognition. I want not to be a New York Times bestseller. I don't necessarily need to strive for that, but I want to be something that would really be worthy of note from book reviewers.
Well, though, you should come to the Thriller Fest and have some fun with us when we go there. I get invited. But I'm excited. MJ Magazine number 12 came out on Friday. This is different, and I'm going to ask Mike to write for the next one. Writers of all ages. I've got children from ages 8 and up. to 17 and 18, that wrote articles for this particular edition of the magazine. I've got children that wrote book reviews that are fantastic. And I have several people, including Colin Eggers, K.J. Howe, Stanley Director, and several other authors that actually read through the magazine, Charles Salzberg, and said it was fantastic. Now, if they would put that on Amazon, that would be great. I'm also excited that the first round of edits are for Silent Voices is coming out, was done today. And Silent Voices is my Faces Behind the Storm series, where the characters are dead and they have done something wrong, and they're there because they deserve to be there. The first two stories are based on real life experiences that were told to me by my grandmothers, and I'm going to make it fiction, but it's based on two experiences. My grandmother was in a Polish sterilization camp, and the other one was sent here to work as a slave to her aunt. So I'm hoping that it comes out hopefully by February, and I'm going to brave it with this one because I think it's really great. So, Mike, where can we find out all about you and everything, and when do you want to come on, and what's the next topic we're going to talk about, because this is fun.
You know, Fran, I think for you and I, the best thing is to let's see when some really big news breaks, and let's just attack it at the time it happens. Yeah, it's,
I'll take care of it.
I love commentating. Right, and as for your audience knows, I am going to put this recording on Crimes and Times, which I'm bringing back to the podcast. Crimes and Times was a live stream video I had, but again, just taking too much of my time, I couldn't continue it, so I think I'm going to bring it back to the podcast. I think I may use this recording with your permission as one of the first podcasts in the return of Crimes and Times. So, and people find all my stuff on Amazon.
Show, by the way.
Thank you. I appreciate it. I really enjoy doing it. Just go to Amazon.com, Michael Tabman, T-A-B-M-A-N, and you'll find my books. And I, it's like most authors, you appreciate people buying it, but you really appreciate a good review in return if they enjoy the book.
Well, after I go off and sign off in a couple of minutes, I'm going to go on Amazon and put all of your links to your books on my Facebook wall so people could have them and they could read them.
Well, thank you, Fran. I appreciate that. Thank you.
That's what I'm going to do. I want to thank you a million times. This is really interesting, and you know what? I'm very impressed that I actually read all these articles, but definitely your answers are fantastic. And now I'm beginning to understand things a lot clearer. I want everybody to have a great day. I don't know. Are you expecting the major snowstorm that we're getting on Sunday? We're getting an ice storm.
Yes, we are. And we're expecting a freezing day for our beloved Kansas City Chiefs. We're expecting like below zero, so it'll be quite a challenge, but they'll live up to it.
Yeah, that's what they said. Martin Luther King's birthday is going to bring us cold weather. They're not sure if it's going to be ice or rain, and I'm praying to God it's rain and it's not ice. But I want to thank everybody. I want to thank Michael Tabman. Thank you so much. And I want to thank everybody that's listening, and I want to thank my friend Marcia who's listening, Marcia Casper-Cook. A good story is a good story. She's listening as we speak right now. I can see her number here. And I want to thank everybody. Everybody have a great day, and bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.